Hey everyone, Corey here. Thanks for tuning into another episode of Flirting with Models. If you're enjoying the show, I'd greatly appreciate it if you'd take a moment to rate, review, and most importantly, share with a friend. Word of mouth is how this podcast grows. And if you'd like to learn more about Newfound's platform of return-stacked mutual funds, ETFs, and model portfolios, head over to returnstacked.com. Now on with the show. Marku, are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. 3, 2, 1, let's jam. Hello and welcome, everyone. I'm Corey Hofstein, and this is Flirting with Models, the podcast that pulls back the curtain to discover the human factor behind the quantitative strategy.
Corey Hofstein is the co-founder and chief investment officer of Newfound Research. Due to industry regulations, he will not discuss any of Newfound Research's funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinion and do not reflect the opinion of Newfound Research. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Newfound Research may maintain positions in securities discussed in this podcast. For more information, visit thinknewfound.com.
In this episode, I chat with Marku Kurti, author of the blog Outcast Beta. Marku is classically trained as an electrical engineer and works on receiver algorithms for mobile phones. A passion for investing, however, led him to pursue his MS in finance, and an interview with Ed Thorpe compelled him to devote his time to better understanding compounding processes. This obsession has driven him to develop a number of analytical and numerical models that provide differentiated insights into topics such as, why do most individual stocks historically underperform cash? How many stocks should an active manager actually hold? And how does the uncertainty of uncertainty help explain the equity risk premium puzzle? With Marku's work, I'm reminded of the phrase, all models are wrong, but some models are useful. His outsider's take provides some unique insights into the benefits and opportunity costs of diversification. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Marku Kurti. Welcome to the show. Excited to have you here, Marku. Marku, I'm going to get that name. I promise you by the end of this, I'm going to get that name. You know, I don't often get the opportunity to interview people who are not strictly financial professionals, but I stumbled across your blog probably through Twitter, and I really loved the work you were doing, and so very excited to have the opportunity to chat with you and talk about all the things that you've been diving deep into the world of finance. So thank you for joining me.
Okay, thank you for having me.
So your background is not technically in finance, though I know you've sort of studied financial topics on your own for many years, but you are classically trained as an electrical engineer, and your day job is actually in receiver algorithms for mobile phones. So my first question is, set the table for us. How did you get involved in finance?
Yeah, I think it was 1999 when I bought my first stocks, and I knew absolutely nothing about stocks except that they always go up. So the tech bubble was building up. And of course, the market soon crashed. And I think I lost something like 90% of my investments. At that time, I was a student in the university studying for my electrical engineering degree. And so luckily, I didn't have much money in absolute terms. But still, it was a big blow. So I basically didn't even want to think about investing for some years. But then I got interested again about stocks and investing. And this time I thought that, okay, it's better that I at least learn the basics before I do anything. So I read the classics like Malkiel, William Bernstein, so on. I learned about different factor styles and some theory about investing. And I think it was around 2014 when I decided that the US is just too expensive for me. And I sold all the US holdings. Again, not a great move, but I was still really interested about the theory. And I heard a podcast by Meb Faber, and Ed Thorpe was talking about the Kelly criterion. And that really caught my attention. And I became so interested in the theory side of things that I applied to a Master of Science program for finance. And basically after that, I was full of ideas and did my own research and studies and so on. And I just needed a place where to document all this. So about a year ago, I set up my website, outcastbeta.com, and here we are.
Well, a lot of your writing on the website ties into this idea that you've called the compounding process capacity. I was hoping you could expand on where does that idea come from, what is it, and what are sort of the core implications of this concept?
Yes, so digital communications is based on information theory by Claude Shannon. And one of the most important results of the information theory is information channel capacity. And it is basically the maximum data rate that can be achieved in a communication system. And if you try to exceed that capacity, data rate will be lower. So how this relates to finance, John Kelly was a colleague of Shannon's at Bell Labs, and he famously derived the Kelly criterion from information theory. And the Kelly criterion is basically about optimal bet size to maximize the growth rate of your bankroll with repeated bets, or more generally, to maximize your geometric growth rate. And Ed Thorpe heard about the Kelly criterion from Shannon, and he applied it in his investments. And there's a paper by Thorpe, which is called The Kelly Criterion in Blackjack, Sports Betting, and the Stock Market. And in this paper, Thorpe derives a continuous variable, continuous time version of the Kelly criterion. And by using the equations from Thorpe, we can derive a result that basically the full Kelly allocation leading to maximum growth rate is achieved exactly when your volatility equals Sharpe ratio, or that your maximum attainable geometric excess rate growth rate is exactly when your Sharpe ratio squared divided by 2. And this is the compounding process capacity, which is the equivalent of the information channel capacity. And in digital communications, you typically want to maximize your data rate, but not always. So sometimes you may want to minimize the latency of the communication system, and then you basically want to minimize the error rate. So no matter what your use case is in digital communications, you always first maximize the information channel capacity. And only after that, you decide how you consume or utilize that acquired capacity. And the capacity is basically maximized by maximizing the signal-to-noise ratio in the receiver. So what is the signal-to-noise ratio in finance? Well, it is the Sharpe ratio squared. So basically, just like in the digital communications, if we follow that example, we first must always maximize the compounding process capacity. And only after that, we decide how we utilize that capacity. If we want to maximize the growth rate, we choose the full Kelly allocation, which is extremely risky strategy. So most people are more risk averse and will choose a lower leverage multiplier. But still, we need to first maximize the signal-to-noise ratio, meaning to maximize the Sharpe ratio, so exactly like the finance theory tells us. So how does this compounding process capacity work empirically? We can test it, for example, by taking the US industry returns by Kenneth French. So I, for example, took 30 industry returns, daily excess returns. We have about 100 years of history for those. And when I leverage each of the industry returns and I want to know what is the maximum excess growth rate that I can get, it turns out that it is for each industry, it's practically exactly the Sharpe ratio divided by 2. So the capacity, which is also called the Shannon limit, basically the Shannon limit works in digital communications, but it works also in finance.
You mentioned this idea that maybe people don't want to use the full capacity. They might have some risk aversion. And one of the things you write about is that investors are more likely to consider drawdown as a more significant indicator of risk than something like volatility, which is used in more classical academic finance. What is the relationship between that Kelly criterion or the compounding process capacity and drawdown risk?
Yeah, so provides a formula which gives you basically the probability of your wealth ever being below a given threshold. So, for example, that your wealth is below 50% of your starting wealth at some point in the future. So it is basically a CDF. So we can just slightly modify that formula and we can get to PDF, and there we can get to expected value of the drawdowns. So there are many types of drawdowns, but this formula either determines the expected drawdowns or it dominates the result. And the expected drawdown, as we derive it, is simply 1/2 of your portfolio volatility divided by Sharpe ratio. Or in the terms of fractional Kelly, it is just your Kelly fraction divided by 2. So for example, you have full Kelly, it's 1 divided by 2, so 50% expected drawdown for full Kelly. But this formula only applies for IID returns, so independent returns. And of course, in real life, we have return autocorrelation, which in practice will make especially maximum drawdowns worse than this formula predicts. But one interesting implication is that the Kelly fraction approaches 2. So your volatility approaches 2 times your Sharpe ratio. It is the point where your growth rate basically approaches, or excess growth rate approaches 0. So it's still positive. But at the same time, your expected long-term drawdown approaches 100%. So you don't need negative growth rate in order to have a certain ruin by expectation, because it's the drawdowns that will kill you. And maybe one more interesting detail is that when we get to PDF of the drawdowns, it is basically flat. So it means that any drawdown is equally probable. So a drawdown between 99 and 100% is equally probable as a drawdown between 0 to 1%. So it kind of gives you a feeling that a full Kelly allocation is extremely risky strategy.
I think the first time I came across your work was shortly after Roni Israeloff published a piece about the number of stocks that investors should actually hold. And you, I think, linked to some of your writing on this idea of the diversification premium within the context of stock diversification. Can you tell us a little bit about what is the diversification premium? What does it mean and why is it so important?
Yeah. So Harry Markowitz famously says that diversification is the only free lunch in investing. And he's, of course, right. But it applies only to arithmetic returns. So when we think geometric returns, the firm-specific idiosyncratic risk is no longer uncompensated, but it's costly because of the variance drag, which drags your growth rate lower. So with geometric returns, we can say that diversification is not only free, but it's negatively priced lunch. And basically, this ties down to this concept of diversification premium, which I define as the geometric growth rate of a single stock portfolio, or the difference between the growth rate of a single stock portfolio and the portfolio of interest. Another concept is diversification premium difference to benchmark, so the difference in diversification premiums between a fully diversified benchmark and your portfolio. And this metric is essentially just a idiosyncratic variance track. And the formula of it only takes one statistical input, so the idiosyncratic variance track of a single stock. So how can we find that value? So we need to use regression analysis. So we take, for example, all the stocks in the CRISP database, and we form a equally weighted portfolio, which is the benchmark, and we use that as the explanatory variable in the regression. And it's important that we now use log returns because we are interested in geometric returns. So once we run the regression, we will find that the beta is 1. And we now have 3 different ways to deduce the idiosyncratic variance of a single stock. The easiest is that we just look into intercept or the alpha of the regression, or we can calculate the variance of the error term and divide it by 2, or we can use the R-squared metric and calculate the benchmark variance and basically figure out the idiosyncratic variance track of a single stock. And out of these 3 methods, the most accurate is the variance of the error term, basically because variance converges quicker than mean. So now, having that information, we can calculate the idiosyncratic variance track for any size portfolio. And if we consider, for example, a case that the idiosyncratic variance track of a single stock is 10%, we know that the market roughly returns 10%, so a single stock will return about 0. And the riskless rate is about 3%, meaning that the expected growth rate of a single stock is lower than riskless rate. So this basically explains the famous result by Bessenbinder, where he finds that most of the stocks lose to riskless rate. And if we draw a parallel to digital communications, in a mobile phone, we typically have multiple antennas. So when we receive the signal through each of the antennas, the signal sums coherently in the receiver, while the noise sums incoherently, which leads to increase in signal-to-noise ratio, leading to increase in the information channel capacity. So now replace the mobile phone by stock portfolio and the individual antennas by individual stocks, and we find that the same math that applies to digital radio design applies to portfolio construction. So basically, now by diversification, we increase the signal-to-noise ratio, meaning the Sharpe ratio, and we increase the compounding process capacity. So in digital communications, we call this diversity gain. And in finance, we may call it diversification premium.
In every introduction to finance class, students typically learn that once a portfolio reaches 20 or 30 stocks, the benefits of diversification on portfolio volatility actually diminishes fairly rapidly. Your work suggests, however, that through the lens of this diversification premium and compounding, that number could actually be significantly different. It's not as simple as minimizing the portfolio volatility to maximize that compounding process capacity. Can you talk a little bit about why 20 to 30 may not be the right number?
Yeah, I think it really boils down to how we define the diversification benefit. So traditionally, it is the reduction in annualized volatility. But if we think in terms of terminal wealth, that the number will be very different. So there was an interesting study by Chen and Israel of how many stocks should you own. And in this study, they basically test what are the terminal wealth outcomes for the unlucky outcomes of the terminal wealth. So the 10th and 25th percentile outcomes. And they find that even if you have 200 stocks in a portfolio, there's still a meaningful increase in the terminal wealth if you have like 300 stocks or so. So I had derived a model earlier which I thought could maybe explain this result. So this model was such that I have a terminal wealth ratio, meaning the terminal wealth percentile of your portfolio divided by the terminal wealth of the diversified benchmark. And this model takes four inputs. It's the idiosyncratic variance of a single stock, time, number of stocks in the portfolio, and the leverage multiplier. So using this model, I plugged in the values from the Jen and Israel study, and it was able to reproduce the curves almost exactly that were in the empirical study. And at the same time, I also derived another model which predicts the probability of losing to benchmark. And it takes the same inputs. And this model can explain the result by Bessempinder, where he finds that less than perfectly diversified portfolios are likely to lose to their diversified portfolio, especially in the long term. So to me, what is kind of remarkable about the model is that it only takes one statistical input, this idiosyncratic variance of a single stock. And using that, it can predict the long-term terminal wealth outcomes. Kind of a simple intuition is that diversification premium differences compound over time, or idiosyncratic variance compounds. So even the smallest annualized growth rate differences compound to meaningful differences in the long term. So one interesting thing about what the model shows clearly is that the conventional wisdom is that you need less diversification the longer the time horizon. But this model based on terminal wealth shows that the opposite is the true truth. So basically, you need to add your diversification in the same or in direct proportion to increase in time horizon length. So in order to keep your terminal wealth ratio constant, so to prevent it from decreasing, or in order to prevent the probability of losing the benchmark from increasing. So if you have 10 stocks for a 5-year period, you will need 50 stocks for a 25-year period. And because the leverage multiplier is squared in the model, it means that diversification becomes extremely important if you use leverage. So if you have 10 stocks without leverage, you will need 40 stocks with a leverage multiplier 2. So I was lucky enough to get Ronnie Israelov's attention with these results. And after he shared my blog in the Twitter, like, did you, Corey? I think it became the most read blog so far. And I think the title of the blog basically summarizes it as it is, that compounding materializes the importance of diversification.
One of the things you said in our pre-call that I thought was really interesting was, and I'll quote you here, if you pick just 10 profitable value stocks, you're basically achieving your benchmark performance. But the same can't be said in the growth space. And the implication I took away there is that depending upon your benchmark for a given style, so an active manager benchmarking to different styles, the appropriate amount of diversification you need to keep up with that benchmark, that diversified benchmark, may actually change. And I was hoping maybe you could provide some intuition as to why that might be the case for how these different styles work.
Yeah, I think the intuition is that different styles have different idiosyncratic variances. And it's well known that big stocks have more idiosyncratic variance than small and micro caps. But the same applies also to different factor styles like value, profitability, or momentum. So in my tests, and there's a caveat, is that I'm using crisp data starting from 1973, so when NASDAQ entered the database. So it is loaded with microcaps, meaning that my results are dominated by microcaps because I used equally weighted portfolios. And it is known that factor returns, for example, are amplified among microcaps. So these results may not directly generalize to big stock space. But anyway, I find that value stocks have considerably lower idiosyncratic variance compared to growth stocks. And the same applies that high profitability has lower idiosyncratic variance than low profitability, and high momentum lower than low momentum. So basically, if you are investing in the space of, say, big profitable value stocks, there really isn't that much idiosyncratic variance to begin with. So the diversification benefit will be lower compared to, say, if you are investing in the space of small, unprofitable growth stocks.
What's the lesson here for active stock pickers? How can they figure out the optimal amount of diversification they need given the benchmark they have?
Well, one thing to consider with geometric returns is that any variance, regardless of its origin, will contribute to variance track. So that means also your alpha return variance will contribute to that. So it means that more consistent alpha is more valuable than less consistent alpha. And how do you get a consistent alpha if you are a stock picker exploiting the idiosyncrasies? Well, I would assume that the more diversification you have more diversified alpha, which is more consistent. So that's one thing. But more importantly, it is again about the idiosyncratic variance track. So if you take, for example, a 10-stock portfolio, big stocks' idiosyncratic variance track will be about 0.5 percentage points. For small stocks, about 1%, and microcaps, about 2%. So it may well be that microcaps are less efficiently priced compared to big stocks. But on the other hand, the idiosyncratic variance track is 4 times higher. So there really is no freelance there. But to me, it boils down to a compromise between alpha decay and the idiosyncratic variance track. So the alpha decay, I mean that you probably have a higher alpha among your best 5 ideas compared to, say, the 45 next best ideas. So concentration is good to kind of prevent the alpha decay. But at the same time, diversification is good to mitigate the idiosyncratic variance track. So the optimum is somewhere in between.
How does the manager's confidence in their ability to generate alpha, either the size of the alpha or the consistency of the alpha, change that answer?
I think it's a tricky question because confidence is subjective, while the idiosyncratic variance track is just math. So no matter how confident you are, objectively, your alpha can be positive, it can be zero, or it can be negative. So say that you trade against momentum and you trade a lot, so your alpha will be negative. But the diversification premium will always be positive. So I think that is one thing to consider. Another thing is that variance is easier to predict than mean returns. So it means basically that idiosyncratic variance is easier to predict than alpha returns. And in my tests, I think one good example is this high profitability style. So the win rate for the high profitability against low profitability in the returns is about 60% of the months. But when I compare the idiosyncratic variances, I find that high profitability has lower idiosyncratic variance than low profitability in 99.6% of the months.
In this sort of same vein of active management, one of the hot button issues as of late has been the size of the largest companies, particularly in the US market today. And there's been a number of pieces published that have argued that if you avoid the biggest stocks, you can potentially outperform the market. There was one paper in particular that suggested that the biggest stocks actually end up losing to their industry or the market on a go-forward basis. In chatting with you, you actually believe that this analysis might be flawed in its design. What do you think it gets wrong?
Well, yeah, it's true that big stocks will lose to their benchmark, be that benchmark a industry portfolio or G-market portfolio. But it does not mean that big stocks are bad investments. And I say that because this line of thinking will not account for the diversification premium. So basically, any randomly selected stock, individual stock, will lose to its benchmark by geometric expectation. So the diversified benchmark, when we use geometric returns, is the wrong reference. The reference should be other individual stocks, how they behave, how they perform. So if we want to use just returns, in this context, I think actually arithmetic returns would be fairer to use. And if we use this methodology, basically, I think we will find that individual small stocks and especially microcaps, very bad investments, because they will lose even more to their benchmark.
There's been a lot of back and forth in the academic literature lately where some authors have argued that investors may actually be better off in all equity portfolio for the long run. Cliff Asness famously wrote his piece, Why Not 100% Equities, which I think it was like back in the mid-1990s, where he demonstrated that a levered 60-40 portfolio empirically outperformed a 100% equity portfolio. Your work in the multi-asset space, from my read, seems to boil down to a pretty simple conclusion, which is that differences in portfolio growth rates and drawdowns are really solely attributable to differences in those portfolio Sharpe ratios. What's the intuition here?
Yeah, I only saw this famous study by Cliff Asness a couple of months ago, and the result very interesting. So I started wondering, can we explain this analytically? So I took the formula of the geometric growth and derived basically just a geometric growth rate difference between two portfolios. And by setting the volatility equal between the portfolios. And the outcome is really simple. It is just a difference in Sharpe ratios multiplied by this common volatility target. So the formula is linear, which was kind of strange to me because we are used to seeing linear results with arithmetic returns, but not with geometric returns. So if we think about the arithmetic returns and this formula, so basically if we have a difference between Sharpe ratios and multiply it by the volatility, and the volatility is now equal for both portfolios here, basically, the volatility reduces away from the formula, and we are just left with the difference between the arithmetic mean returns. So for arithmetic returns, the result is kind of obvious, at least in the hindsight. But why the same formula works for geometric returns as well? It turns out it is because now that we have equal volatility between the portfolios, it means that the volatility drag is equal too. And when we calculate the growth rate difference, the volatility drag reduces away. So basically, we have found a common ground between those who think that portfolio returns should be assessed based on arithmetic returns and those who think that geometric returns should be used. Because in this case, the result is exactly the same. And if we think about the drawdowns, we can have a formula for expected drawdown ratio. And it turns out that now that the volatility is equal between the portfolios, it is simply a ratio of Sharpe ratios. But we again need to remember that this formula only works accurately for IID returns. So autocorrelation again will change the empirical results. But we can think of it as a kind of underlying expected drawdown ratio on which the autocorrelation will operate on. So I tested these formulas empirically, and the growth rate difference seems to work extremely accurately with empirical data up to a level of about 2x all stocks portfolio volatility. So after that, basically, we start to deviate from the theoretical prediction, and if we leverage too much, the result collapses. If we think about the result of the expected drawdown ratio empirically, basically the maximum drawdowns are equal between the portfolio of leveraged 60-40 and the all equity portfolio. So based on my tests, the autocorrelation is even worse for the 60-40 portfolio compared to the all equity portfolio. So the drawdown distribution is even more fat-tailed. So this kind of eats out the Sharpe ratio difference or advantage that the 60-40 has. But if I compare the mean drawdowns across all time instants, then actually this formula quite accurately predicts the empirical outcome. And I wanted to test the result of the original ASNES study, but this study did not give the Sharpe ratio, so I went to see the replication study by Jeremy Schwartz. And it either did not provide the Sharpe ratios, but it provided the riskless rates. And I was able to approximate the Sharpe ratios by some reverse engineering. And when I plug in these approximated Sharpe ratios into my formulas, the growth rate difference is very close to this empirical ASNES study growth rate difference. And I derived one more formula, which is a benchmark terminal wealth multiplier, which basically tells you how many times higher your terminal wealth will be after the investment period compared to your benchmark portfolio. And in the ASNES study, the leveraged 60-40 had a, I think, 1.61 times higher terminal wealth compared to all equity portfolio after 68 years. And my formula predicted 1.6. So the formulas seem to work very accurately, empirically.
The conclusion that that article that you wrote kind of draws into is very much in line with, in a way, modern portfolio theory, which says find the highest Sharpe portfolio and begin to add leverage. The key question there when you start talking about compound growth rates is when to stop adding leverage. And you've done some interesting work around the idea of introducing the concept of the uncertainty of risk. And some of the things you've talked about already on this episode, the inputs are theoretically known constants. That is certainly not always the case. We don't always know the idiosyncratic vol of a stock. We don't always know the volatility of an asset. Can you talk a little bit about your work around that sort of uncertainty of risk concept and how it impacts these optimal leverage choices?
Yeah. So at one time, I was again playing with the data and the simulations. And I noticed that if I make the parameters of the simulation random variables, geometric growth rate will be lower. So again, I started wondering, why is that? And I went back to this Torp's paper, which is something I often do. So to see Torp's geometric growth rate derivation, because I remembered that it was very intuitive to me. So I slightly modified the derivation so I derive geometric excess growth rate instead of growth rate because it makes the derivation simpler. And I make the input parameters random variables. So then I just follow Thorpe's derivation. And the outcome is that the formula is the same as the original formula, except that the variance track part is now different. So the original variance track is just variance divided by two. But now it becomes expected volatility squared plus the variance of the volatility estimate. So this now, if we don't have any uncertainty about the risk, it converges to the original formula as the variance of the volatility estimate is zero. So now the variance in the presence of uncertainty about risk is higher than without uncertainty. It means, of course, that also volatility must be higher in the presence of uncertainty about risk. Sharpe ratio will be lower, geometric growth rate will be lower, optimal leverage, meaning the full Kelly leverage, will be lower, and compounding process capacity, so the maximum geometric growth rate, will be lower. These are all negatives. But there's one positive, which is that diversification premium will be higher in the presence of uncertainty about idiosyncratic risk. Now, there's more to diversify. So there are some interesting implications. One is that now ex ante geometric growth rate and optimal leverage will be lower than exposed realized values. And this is because the realized values have zero uncertainty, but the estimates of the future parameters always have uncertainty. And there's another reason why the ex ante values will be lower, and that is related to the fact that volatility can never be negative. And it means basically that the distribution of volatilities must be positively skewed. And if I take empirical monthly volatilities or yearly volatilities and look at the distribution of those, it resembles log normal distribution. So now with positive skewness, median value will be lower than mean value. So if we take just randomly pick one realized historical volatility value, it is likely lower than the true mean value. Another interesting implication is that behavioral economics basically says that ambiguity aversion or uncertainty aversion is an irrational behavioral bias. So the ambiguity aversion means that people prefer known risks over unknown risks. But now, in the light of this result, I would say that uncertainty aversion is perfectly rational behavior.
You mentioned on our pre-call that this uncertainty related to risk or the volatility of volatility may actually help explain the equity risk premium puzzle. Can you explain how these two concepts could be linked?
Yes. Here I'm referring to geometric risk premium puzzle. So if we think about what is geometric risk premium, it is basically the arithmetic risk premium minus the variance track part. And now basically the variance track part, we can decompose it to risk part and the uncertainty about the risk part. So based on my results, basically now the variance track with uncertainty is higher. So investors should require compensation for both bearing risk and for bearing uncertainty. And if we think about investors, say 100 years ago, then we did not have any index funds. And basically you were forced to bear idiosyncrasies, or say you had 5 or 10 stocks. So now your variance track have 4 components. So the systematic risk, the uncertainty related to systematic risk, the idiosyncratic risk, and the uncertainty related to idiosyncratic risk. So based on this, I would say that today the required risk premium should be lower because we don't need to bear any idiosyncratic risk or uncertainty related to it. And therefore, basically the market valuations should be higher, I think.
With all these ideas around compound growth and leverage, one of the ideas you introduced on your blog was this concept of the compound market parabola, which is sort of analogous to the capital market line in traditional finance. Can you talk maybe a little bit about the differences between your CMP versus the traditional CML?
I like to think the idea of capital market parabola as portfolio theory for practitioners, because the capital market line, the traditional one, it's based on arithmetic returns, but typically long-term investors really care about geometric returns. So the portfolio selection part between these two concepts is identical. So we basically maximize the Sharpe ratio in portfolio selection, no matter whether we are talking about arithmetic or geometric returns. But then the leveraging or deleveraging part is very different, because when you have arithmetic returns, you leverage along the capital market line. But with geometric returns, you leverage along this parabola, which has a maximum value at the compounding process capacity. So the shape is very different, and I think the parabolic shape demonstrates the diminishing marginal benefit of additional allocation to risky assets, which the arithmetic version doesn't do at all. And basically, intuitively, I think people, when they think about expectation, they think about a 50-50 probability of being above or below the expectation, although this is not the mathematical truth. But the capital market parabola delivers exactly that. It is a 50-50 chance of being above or below it. And I think one way to think about it is a risk-neutral investor. So in conventional finance theory with arithmetic returns, a risk-neutral investor only cares about expected return and doesn't care about risk. So he will basically select a asset with the highest expected return and will leverage it as much as possible, basically up to infinity. And interestingly, if you leverage approaches infinity, your arithmetic expected return approaches infinity as well. But at the same time, your probability of ever achieving that return or higher approaches zero. So if we think about the risk neutral investor in the world of geometric returns, we can define a risk neutral compounder who basically only cares about two things. He first maximizes his Sharpe ratio, and then he leverages until his volatility equals Sharpe ratio. So a risk-neutral compounder in the world of geometric returns only cares about two parameters, Sharpe ratio and volatility. So how different is that from the world of arithmetic returns, where the risk-neutral investor only cares about his arithmetic expected return?
So in reading your blog, one of the quotes that comes to mind for me is this idea that all models are wrong, but some are useful. And there's so much intuition that can be built with some of the math that you've derived and the models that you've built and written about on your blog. But they are, without a doubt, unrealistic in the real world sense. They often assume that you can borrow and lend at the risk-free rate. Portfolios are rebalanced to target weights continuously and without cost and at infinite frequency, none of which, of course, are real world realities. What is your intuition for how the results might change if we begin to move ourselves towards the real world? If we start to introduce higher costs of borrowing or discrete rebalancing or transaction costs or even at the extreme, things like margin calls that suddenly bring path dependency to bear?
Yeah, I'm not an expert on implementation, but I do think that once you start to use leverage, basically implementation becomes very important. And if I take, for example, my empirical tests with this leveraged 60-40 portfolio against the all equity portfolio, the leverage multiplier is about 1.6, and the excess growth rate in excess of the all equity portfolio is about 0.8 percentage point per year. So if my math is correct here, I get a number about 1.3 percentage points or 130 basis points. So you basically need to have a cost of leverage in excess of riskless rate plus the cost or the trading costs in excess of all equity portfolio trading costs need to exceed this 130 basis points before you lose this theoretical edge that you have because of the higher Sharpe ratio. To me, 1.3 percentage sounds like something not a very healthy margin if you are, say, a average retail investor and you need to use a margin account or similar to implement your leverage. So I would imagine that you easily lose your edge coming from the Sharpe ratio. But if you use instruments like ETFs that can implement the leverage using derivatives and so on, so, well, you are the expert, Corey, but I would assume that this 130 basis points in that case is quite healthy margin. And the rebalancing frequency is actually something that I have done some studies about. So it is true that my models, they assume infinite rebalancing frequency, but we can test it. I have tested it, for example, by using all equity data, daily data from Kenneth French. And basically, by leveraging, we can realize the capital market parabola, so the parabolic shape of the mean return as a function of leverage. And when I do that with daily returns, I find that the empirical curve is very close to theoretical curve, which basically tells me that with daily rebalancing, you can practically achieve the theoretical result. So you don't really need infinite rebalancing. But then when I go to monthly returns, I start to see that around about 2x stocks volatility, we start to deviate from the theoretical curve. So we cannot, for example, achieve the theoretical maximum growth rate. And soon after the full Kelly allocation, basically the result collapses. So I did some additional tests again with monthly rebalancing using the same parameters as with the empirical data, but now using a simulation and normally distributed returns. And now I can see basically that monthly rebalancing is sufficient. So we are very close to the theoretical curve again. So to me, this tells that basically the fat tailedness of the empirical returns combined with too much leverage means that monthly rebalancing will not be enough. basically if you use too much leverage.
When I look at all of your writing, the title of a recent article you wrote, which is Diversification as a Negative Price Lunch, sort of distills a lot of your blog down into a single phrase. And now that you've been writing for a little over a year and doing this research for much longer, looking back on everything that you have done over the last several years, how would you think about summarizing the totality of the work?
Maybe it is that in conventional finance theory, we use metrics like arithmetic returns and volatility, which I think are all very important. But I like to use in my work, I try to use metrics that I think people and long-term investors really care about. So I use metrics like geometric growth rate, terminal wealth, and drawdowns. And I think it is about geometric metrics and those compounding over time. And often if we use these different metrics, we get surprising results, like for example this result that actually with terminal wealth, the importance of diversification increases as the time horizon increases. So maybe I could summarize it by saying that free lunch is good, but negatively priced lunch is even better.
Well, we've come to the end of the episode, and in this season, I'm asking every guest the same question as I do with prior seasons. But the question this season is, what is your current obsession? And obviously, I think we spent a lot of time in this episode talking about one of your obsessions, but this can be market related. This could be life related, a book, a movie, things you're interested and passionate about. What are you currently obsessed with?
Yeah, so as we discussed, I'm not a finance professional, so this finance thing has been a hobby for me, or a passion, or perhaps a obsession. And I think I'm a person who needs to be obsessed about something at all times. But I think that this has been such a big obsession for me lately, this finance thing, that I don't at this moment have other obsessions, but I really hope that I will have some, hopefully soon.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a really unique dive. I think some really fascinating insights. And again, the listeners, please check out outcastbeta.com, where you can find all of this writing and hopefully much more in the future. So again, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.